Beltwide Proceedings provides us with a very valuable historical document that an awful lot of other commodities in the U.S. would benefit from, and it's with that in mind that I've decided to submit what was a project that came out of the blue for us in the last year. Most of you, I think, have probably been in the situation where you plan your year, hire your people, get everything planned out, ready to go, and then something more important comes along, and that's what this was. The quick overview is that you heard, some of you at least, were at the session yesterday on pink bollworm eradication, and you know that there is an extremely impressive undertaking in the Southwest to eradicate pink bollworm. And it is about as environmentally friendly as one can get, based on broad-scale use of BT cotton, pheromones, sterile insects over the top of it. I mean, this is the perfect example for those of us teaching classes of integrating soft technologies. And then the stopgap for sites that are giving them trouble is limited strategic use of insecticides. Well, we go out and do our pink bollworm collections each year and with the idea of doing the monitoring for the cryotoxins. Cry1AC first through all of them, then go and test them all with Cry2AB2. And based on a problem in 2006, Larry Antilla and Mike Whitlow from the Cotton Research and Protection Council approached us and said, is there any chance you could take a look and see if one of the problems we've experienced in a particular area could have a basis in resistance? So it was on that basis that we investigated this potential resistance problem, and it's for the long term that we want to have this recorded in the proceedings. It's important at this point for me to say that was 06. 07, how many insecticide sprays this year? Virtually none, right? So it was something that didn't recur. Typical monitoring of pink bollworm resistance. You've heard the presentations of the mind-numbing array of collections and tests that we do in any given year. This was just built right on that. 300 to 2,000 bolls from any given field. Crack the bolls from the different locations. We get the diet thanks to USDA APHIS. This is the same diet that they produce in the sterile production facility. This is just typical rearing of individuals that have come out of bowls, and then the adult oviposition cups. These things are handled one at a time, as most of us do with the heliothines, incredibly time intensive. And so it really was too good of an opportunity for us to not superimpose, jumping on this question, to evaluate the potential for pesticide, conventional insecticide resistance. This shows you where we have those individuals in single cups that have matured, and then they cut out of these little cups within these pet food containers, and we harvest then the pupae from the individual cultures here. Very quickly, the chemicals that we looked at started first and foremost with chlorpyrifos, because that was the target material that had been used repeatedly, and I emphasize that. The measures taken were extraordinary, given the extraordinary needs of eradication at this specific site. But then we also tried to, as much as we could, come in with other alternative compounds so that we could get an idea of if indeed there was a problem to chlorpyrifos that showed up, what were the alternatives. And I won't go into too many details, but you know the vial, or when I'm in this part of the world, I should speak correctly, the vial test that involves 1 mL of solution in these scintillation, 20 ml scintillation vials, adults that are a gated cohort, so we knew their age, 1 to 4 days, 24-48-hour readings depending on the material, 5 adults per vial, 4 to 10 reps depending on the productivity of the culture, total of 15 field strains, and then our contrast with lab strains. So here's a typical sort of grid of cultures times chemicals. And you see also what got added this last year, and this is the only one of these that's an 07 collection, and this was brought to us from our colleagues in Texas who asked us to test a culture that was of question to them in a problem, an area where they were having some problems. Typical vial tests, the technical material, you know, into the vial. This is the adults isolated, randomized, both sexes being tested. The vials put on a conventional hot dog roller in the lab, high tech. The range of concentrations in individuals that represent a typical test. Here you see individuals at 24, 48 hours, fat and happy, and one's not quite so at the end of the evaluation period. Well, as usual, with situations like this where you have very strong evidence from the field, it's not surprising to find that you get some correlation in the lab, and indeed that's what happened. These first show you three different field strains from 06, Gila Valley, Arizona, Imperial Valley, California, Somerton, Arizona, and then our Cry1AC resistant strain that can survive on BT cotton. If you put individuals' eggs on BT bolls, you get about 50% of these individuals that will complete development on Bolgard. And the important point here is to just see what's going on here. 1, 10, and 100. Smoked. Nothing whatsoever. Other field strains, this is the aphis strain, long-standing lab strain, some 30 years in culture. Looks just like a lot of our field strains. Parker Valley, Mojave Valley, we're starting to pick up some survivors here at 10. At one of the Mojave collections, at the other one, not at 10 or 100, but survivorship at this concentration of one. Now remember, these are log interval jumps here. These are big jumps, right? We've got everything dying at one in our susceptible cultures. And lastly, for chlorpyrifos, the sites of the problems, or most of the severe problems that they were having, were in this Eloy, Arizona City area. And you can see now we have survivors of 1, 10, and 100. So now we're up to 100 times the concentration that killed everything in many of our field strains. I contend that you don't have to cogitate too long about the significance of this kind of a jump. And indeed, there was one other area where we saw these survivors at 100 in the Arlington area, which is about another 100 miles from this problem area. So, can you select for resistance to chlorpyrifos and pink bollworm? Yes, you can vary. But again, these were extraordinary selection conditions. The good news is that it didn't rear its head in 07. These are 06 data. How about the other compounds? Well, oxymil is used by growers, not infrequently. It's not the most commonly used compound, but we were surprised at how little we killed. Didn't find a lot of variation with respect to oxymil, but we still had survivors of very high concentrations. So quite interesting there. Nothing much to report in terms of huge differences. Profenifos, on the other hand, gave us some striking, at least significant differences between strains. I'm just highlighting one here in that same area where the chlorpyrifos was giving us trouble. You can see 96, 90s, 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 and then here's a 50, essentially. We could have something there, but I will emphasize we have no field verification of the profenifos situation, and field verification of impact on efficacy is central to contextualizing any of these differences we find in the lab. The pyrethroids also showed us some striking differences between selections. Again, I'm just highlighting one. We don't have field verification of this as we do with the chlorpyrifos, where we can say, yeah, they sprayed chlorpyrifos and it didn't give them the desired results. We can't say that at this point, but We wanted to put these data into the record so people could see where we stand and the variation that exists. In summary, intensive use of chlorpyrifos then resulted in what is very, very clearly a strong resistance to this insecticide, and we have concordance with field observations, but there is no evidence of recurrence of this problem within Arizona, and very, very limited insecticide use in the past year within the program, and clear evidence of reduced susceptibility of some field strains to the pyrethroid, lambda-cyhalothrin, and the organophosphate propanophos, but no confirmatory field results to contextualize whether or not that impacts performance at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes for questions.
The very negative insecticide use is probably related to just low population threat in those
cells. Well, we've got the program leaders here. I'll let them vet anything that I say here, but the amount of BT cotton being used, conjunction with sterols, conjunction with pheromones, I'm surprised we see any in many of these areas. And indeed, the levels are very, very low.
I guess that leads into the question I really want to know is, what is it, if you're planning, you're using all these other things, is there really a need for this insecticide and things like that?
I'm ready to pull up the program. We have an unusual situation in Arizona, and our program is has its laboratory base. And in order to get that left credit from the grower, we have to run the batch and a 4-year run. And so in other programs where they're kind of open-ended, and we can take longer to achieve our goal if we face, say, a numbers minimum reduction year by year. But in this case, we didn't have that option, we don't have that option, we have to be very aggressive. Sterols and the pheromones are density, they're inversely density dependent. So getting the numbers down as quickly as possible.
And what I didn't say, Roger, is 2006 was the first year. Did I get? Yeah. No, my days mixed up. So this was the first year going in, and this was just a hot spot. Happened to be where there was some experimental plots, among other things. I'm sorry.
Do you think it may have changed the behavior of the insect? Both resistant insects may have a different behavior and may sometimes susceptible to the eradication program?
It's always a very good bet that resistance is causing all sorts of other changes in the pest. The question is, are there relevant changes? And I can't answer that at this time. But we do know one thing. When you're using a suite of low toxicity, environmentally benign control methods such as they are, that you can expect all kinds of positive impact on pesticide susceptibility over the large area, and we would expect that there would be very little benefit to having pesticide resistance genes in most of Arizona these days for conventional materials.
Thank you.